I'm Morris Wee. I'm a parish pastor in Northfield, Minnesota, and I'm doing the Bible studies last week and this week. And the one Doug Kanicka is going to do them next week is sitting right back there, so you can get advance notice if you're going to be around on Monday. I'm to plug a book that's in the bookstore because I recommended that they stock this book. It's a collection of sermons that just came out, published by Gustavus Adolphus College. They're all addressed to violence, and I think it's entitled The Design of God's Great Love, Overcoming the Violence in Our Lives. And they sent me notice of this new book because they put one of my sermons into it. So I thought, well, Holden likes to have the teachers have their own stuff in the bookstore, so I'd bring that out. Has very little to do directly with what we're doing today in the Bible study. But violence has been an issue in the village this week and was the forum topic last night. I think some of the sermons in there are helpful biblical and Christian responses to those problems. Let's open our study with prayer. Gracious God, we thank you for the gift of this gorgeous day and for the gift of your word. We ask that it become for us a living word so that it moves us, changes us, directs us, and reminds us again of your love and constant presence in our lives. We pray these things in Christ's name. Amen. This week, we've looked at the stories of four women. And you might wonder how I chose these particular four rather than others that are some may be somewhat better known. So in answer to that assumed question, I'm going to read you the opening of the Gospel of Matthew. It begins with a genealogy. So I anticipate that most of you will not have read this, just as I always skip over genealogies. But the genealogy runs for 42 generations from Abraham to Jesus, and it mentions all the men and four women. There are a couple of other exceptions that are interesting, so I'll read it quickly, this part of it. An account of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, which is an interesting note. Those brothers are all the brothers of Joseph who sold him into slavery. And Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. The twins are mentioned because they're twins, and kind of interesting story there, by Tamar. The first woman who's mentioned here, and we looked at her story on Monday. And Perez, the father of Hezron, Hezron, the father of Aram, Aram, the father of Amminadab, Amminadab, the father of Nahshon, Nahshon, the father of Salmon, Salmon, the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz, the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. And the genealogy goes on down from Solomon to Jesus. Those are the only four women mentioned before Mary in this genealogy. And other women, the mothers of all of these men, are known. Many of them are known. Many of them are well known, and the stories about them are important. So one might ask, as I have asked each day, why are these four women singled out? What is there about their stories? What is there about the story of Ruth that is so distinctive or important to the Hebrew understanding of who we are that this name is mentioned in the genealogy? And maybe we'll have a sense of that after today and tomorrow looking at Ruth. This book probably works better, looks more like a short story than any other book in Scripture. Jonah is another one that people look at and they feel like this was written as a coherent unit and has the features of a story. This has nothing to do with the validity of the incidents. I don't mean to say that it was it maybe didn't happen or was invented by somebody, but it's put together, it's organized in such a way that it works like a story works. It's a nice concise unit. There aren't too many loose ends, so it's kind of fun to look at in this way and read straight through, as we will, reading two chapters today and two chapters tomorrow. However, I'll try to give you something at the end today so that if you can't come tomorrow, you'll at least have gone away with something. The major development in this story is from death to life. You see, as soon as we start to read it, that it starts with death and it ends with birth. And that's worked out then in small units along the way, too. And, well, I'll say more about that after we've read it. So let's have the reading of Ruth 1 and 2 with you volunteers. We'll read straight through. Oh, one more thing. Yeah, there is a relevant issue here that you might not be familiar with. The rule of levirate marriage. This figured in the story of Tamar, importantly, and it figures importantly in this story. This is the rule that said that if a man and a woman were married and the man should die without a child, that the man's brother was required to marry his widow, so that if they were to have a child, that child would be regarded as the dead brother's child, so that the lineage of that man who had died would not be lost, but would be continued. Then if they had additional children, they'd be considered the second man's children. But the brother was required to marry the widow, so that the, not so much, I suppose you could say partly for her sake, so that she'd have some security, and partly for the sake of the brother's lineage, so that I wouldn't die out. So that's the rule of levirate marriage, and it figures here in this first chapter. Yeah.
Well, it's also important for inheritance purposes, too, isn't it?
Because if one man had two sons, and one son died, without issue, and that son's lineage was not replaced, then everything would go to the first son.
To the next son. Yes.
Right.
And of course, that's one of the things we noticed in the last time we ran into this. Was that just yesterday? This kind of rule keeps coming around. But the motivation, let's say there are two sons. The oldest son dies. Second son is supposed to marry the widow to provide sons for the brother, so that this second son now will not inherit the whole of the family inheritance. Well, your incentive to do that might be less than complete. You know, you might think, I'd rather inherit the whole thing for myself and my children. And this was possibly the reason that Onan was unwilling to have children with his wife, which was Tamar, and that's another story. But, yeah, thank you. Okay, let's read.
In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was bereft of her two sons and her husband. Then she started with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her daughters-in-law,
"Go, return each of you to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find a home, each of you, in the house of her husband."
Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept, and they said to her,
"No, we will return with you to your people."
But Naomi said,
"Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me."
Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her, and she said,
"See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her..."
This is Naomi still. Excuse me.
"See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law."
But Ruth said,
"Entreat me not to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if even death parts me from you."
And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said,
"Is this Naomi?"
She said to them,
"Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has afflicted me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?"
So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a man of wealth, and of a family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi,
"Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain. After him in his sight I shall find favor."
And she said to him,
"Go, to her daughter."
So she set forth and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers,
"The Lord be with you."
And they answered,
"The Lord bless you."
Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers,
"Oh, whose maiden is this?"
And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered,
"She is the Moabite who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab."
Go on, that's still your line.
"Oh, she said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the reapers.' So she came, and she has been on her feet from early this morning until now, without resting even for a moment."
Then Boaz said to Ruth,
"Now listen, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my maidens. Let your eyes be upon the field which they are reaping, and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to molest you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn."
Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him,
"Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me when I am a foreigner?"
But Boaz answered her,
"All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told me, and how you left your father and mother, your native land, and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord recompense you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge.
Then she said,
"You are most gracious to me, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not one of your maidservants."
And at mealtime Boaz said to her,
"Come here and eat some bread, and dip your morsel in the wine."
So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her parched grain, and she ate until she was satisfied and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed the young men, saying,
"Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her, and also pull out some from bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her."
So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. She showed her mother-in-law what she had gleaned, and she also brought out what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her,
"Where did you glean today, and where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you."
So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said,
"The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz."
And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law,
"Blessed be he by the Lord whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead."
Naomi also said to her,
"The man is a relative of ours, one of our nearest kin."
And Ruth the Moabite said,
"Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close by my servants till they have finished all my harvest.'"
And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law,
"It is well, my daughter, that you go out with his maidens, lest in another field you be molested."
So she kept close to the maidens of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvest, and she lived with her mother-in-law.
Thank you. Okay, any technical questions about what's going on before we start looking at details? All right. The major movement, as I said, is from the death at the beginning to life. And if you look at how this story starts, it starts right away with famine. In the days when the judges ruled, there was famine in the land. Very first thing you get is famine. And in that first sentence, the requirement that people move from their home, Bethlehem in Judah, to the country of Moab. People who were despised at certain times anyway by the Israelites, but apparently there was better possibility for food over there across the Jordan. And so over they journeyed, a completely different country, worshiping different gods. And within the next sentence or two, it's mentioned a second time that they are from Bethlehem in Judah, reminding us what a sacrifice it is and what a loss it is for them to leave their home and go to Moab. That's the first loss. Immediately, Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. Next thing that happens is the two sons die, and we are told in verse 5, the woman was left without her two sons and her husband, and incidentally, without her homeland. So in this little opening paragraph of the story, we have four losses in a row for Naomi, who incidentally I regard as the main character in the story. The story is about Naomi. It happens that Ruth is also a major figure in the story, and perhaps the most memorable one, and is the one in the genealogy, so it's named after her. But it's Naomi who incurs the main losses at the beginning, and who in some ways the story is about. Food and life are tied up here then. The death and the famine go hand in hand, and we'll see in the course of this story how important harvest is as well as birth. So she hears that there's food and decides to return home to Bethlehem. but advises her daughters-in-law to stay in Moab with their own people, the places they're likely to be able to marry again. She doesn't have a husband or sons. She's got no security, no means of support. There's no point in them staying with her. They both love her. They want to go with her, both of them. But she talks them out of it, or talks Orpah out of it, and in the course of it, expresses some of her own feeling about what's happened. The hand of the Lord has turned against me. It is bitter for me on your account, she says. Or, as my translation has it, quite different, it has been far more bitter for me than for you. And she's suffered more losses. They've all lost loved ones. So Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, presumably meaning kissed her goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. And then we have this wonderful vow, really, of affection and commitment on the part of Ruth, which many of us have probably heard at weddings. Have you not? You've heard this at weddings. It's as a beautiful a vow of commitment as we find in Scripture. And it's not only two women who are speaking here, but it's a daughter and a mother-in-law. It's just kind of wonderful irony. But it's obviously heartfelt and extremely important for both Ruth and Naomi. And a moving statement, not just, I will go with you, I will live with you, but I will become one of your people who are foreigners to me, or among whom I will be a foreigner, more significant. She's going to be an outsider, and she's going to try to understand what it is to worship another God. And not only that, I'll be with you to the death. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Maybe these things, in a culture as transient as ours, don't seem as significant as they might be, but to not be buried with your ancestors also is a great sacrifice that she's willing to make for her mother-in-law. Notice what Naomi's reaction is to this statement. When Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. She doesn't say anything. Naomi, as I see this, is so embittered and so discouraged by the things that have happened to her. The Lord has turned against me. That she can't, she doesn't have a good word to say to Ruth about this vow that Ruth makes to her. And it's sad. And Naomi is in a terrible state. So that when she gets back to Bethlehem, everybody hears that she's back. The town was stirred. The whole town was stirred because of them. A small enough town that when Naomi comes back with her daughter-in-law, everybody finds out about it. And they ask, is this Naomi? Good old Naomi, who must have had some very appealing characteristics that Ruth would decide to stick with her. But she says, no, I'm not Naomi, which my footnote says means pleasant. Call me Mara, which means bitter. For the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Is this accurate? Not really, is it? She went away empty of food. She went away because there was no food. She did have a husband and sons, means of support. Now she only has a daughter-in-law, which is not means of support. But she discounts entirely that daughter-in-law's commitment to her, which has been so lovely in our ear, and the fact that there's food in the land that she comes back to. Yes?
She is talking about the overriding concern of providing male descendants, which is what, if we don't consider that, which isn't that big a deal, you know, but we have children,
right.
Many people today don't choose to have children,
right.
But that was such very much both religious and community obligation.
Right. That's, and that's the role of a woman in that place primarily, is to provide male descendants. That's why barrenness was such an issue for many of those families.
And that's why she says to Ruth, why are there to Ruth and why would you want to go along with me? I won't have any more sons. Or
right.
If I did,
yeah.
Would you be willing to wait?
Yeah.
Go someplace where you can find men to marry.
Yeah. And keep those statements of Naomi in mind for the end of the story, because while it seems self-evident on the surface that she will not have sons, it's interesting the way the story ends. Well, I suppose I can't put it that way without just going ahead and saying. Ruth has a child at the end of this story, and the people of the community say to Naomi, blessed be the Lord who has not left you without next of kin. Shucks.
17, a son has been born.
Yeah, and they said, a son has been born to Naomi. Now, not literally, quite, but someone who is regarded as a descendant, close enough that the community says a son has been born to Naomi. So what seemed impossible to her was not impossible, as we see for God, as elsewhere we're reminded in Scripture. But at this point, that's her perspective. I went away full. I had two sons and I had a husband. The Lord has brought me back empty. But I do think one can note the ways in which she has pushed her own despair, has carried her to extremes here, and she doesn't think there's any hope. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has dealt harshly with me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? So they return, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. The last sentence of that first chapter introduces the first little word of hope that is the transition. And we'll see how harvest and food, along with life and birth, are the issues that continue to crop up, as it were, in this story. The next chapter has a completely different tone to it. Ruth decides to go out and see if she can find some food using the normal means, which is going into a field after the harvesters have come through and picking up what's left over, what's fallen on the ground, gleaning, which is the way the poor were supported in that culture. It appears that you had to go ask permission to do this, but it was typical that poor people then would glean behind. Somebody at the first group said, well, we still do this in our community. We have a system of gleaning in the fields. And somebody else said, well, we have a system of gleaning in the grocery stores, where people go around and pick up the things that are going to be thrown out by the grocery stores and make sure they're distributed to people. So this is not completely inconsistent with what still happens among us.
And in some cultures, the reapers were often, and I think comes in here, but that was carried on in other places where they would deliberately not reap very carefully. They would leave more than they would normally.
Yeah, just as Boaz instructs them to do.
System.
Yeah, yeah. At one point, Boaz instructs them to, first of all, let her glean among the sheaves, which, as I see it, you know, the sheaves are what they've already harvested and stacked up there. Let her kind of pull some out of there. But then Boaz also says, also, you know, pull some out and presumably leave little bunches around for her to, so that they'll be extra. Exactly what you're suggesting may have been typical elsewhere. Anyway, Boaz shows up in the second chapter, the new character, and Ruth, who, unlike her mother-in-law, has not given up hope, heads out to find some food. hoping to find someone who will permit her to do this. Boaz is willing, and then he takes an interest in her. He asks who she is. When he finds out who she is, the one who came back with Naomi, he goes and invites her to glean, tells her to get water, protects her from the men in the field, an issue that comes up again. Molest was the word used, I think, in your translation. Mine says, so the men won't bother you. But we get the picture. It's sort of, at the very least, it's the harassment at the construction site, you know, and could be a lot worse. So she's protected from that. And finally, Boaz, as this relationship progresses in this chapter, Boaz has lunch with her and gives her food to eat, enough so that there's some left over, which he brings home to Naomi. And in the course of it, when she says, why have you taken such an interest in me? Boaz says, we've heard how you have treated your mother-in-law, Naomi. It's that vow that we saw in the first chapter that and how that's been played out that has really made its mark with Boaz and with others, so that he wishes her the blessings of God here in a rather moving statement to her. You have a full reward from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. She may still feel at that point that it's, or in the near future, that it's Boaz's wings that she's looking for refuge.
That's under. Kind of an issue in the book here is the connections between the protective and redeeming activity of God and the activity of the human agents that become the means by which that is being carried out.
Right.
There's a strong emphasis here on the ingenuity and the perseverance and charity of human characters,
right.
And yet it's set within that theological outlook.
Right. It's very interesting.
God has emptied his hands, and now God is filling his hands with blessings, but there are people that are doing this.
Right. There are human agents for these blessings of God. And as we'll see, for Naomi, Ruth is one of those human agents, and for both Ruth and Naomi, Boaz is a human agent of the blessings of God. And those Boaz, at any rate, attributes these things to God. And you see in these stories, this exact same issue came up when we were looking at the story of Joseph and all this miraculous stuff that Joseph was doing in Egypt to preserve the world from famine, and attributing what was happening to God. And we were asking the question, you know, how much individual human ingenuity is involved here, and when and how much do we attribute that to the work of God? Good question. Well, I'd like to give us some time to talk in smaller groups, because there are so many of us. And so I'd like to invite you to get in groups of three or four. And two questions to discuss that I think are interesting. One is, do you see further contrasts between chapter 1 and chapter 2? Just looking at the movement in the story here, are there further contrasts between chapter 1 and chapter 2? And then, what are the characteristics of Ruth that are outstanding? Which is the question we want to ask in connection with the genealogy, too. So, would you take... what do we have? Probably 10 minutes in groups of three or four and discuss, I'll write this on the board, contrast between chapter 1 and 2, characteristics of Ruth. Okay, I'm going to ask you to break off those discussions and share some of these things with one another. Let's see what you came up with. What do you notice about changes between the first and the second chapter? Were there some other perspectives or details that we hadn't mentioned yet? Yeah.
Well, chapter one has a lot of emotional content that really kind of Ruth and her sisters kind of bottoming out almost, you know, like that it's, you know, it's the hand of God is struck against her.
Right. Like that was Naomi.
Yeah.
That's the mother-in-law.
Right. And then, and so it's a very, you know, she's talking about how everything is gone for all three of them, and, you know, it's really,
right,
you know, very, very emotional. And then Ruth responds with this incredible statement of commitment.
Right.
Just a marvelous, to a person that doesn't sound like she'd be the kind of person that you really feel like embracing at that moment.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good point. And Naomi does not seem a very appealing person at that moment. And nevertheless,
and not to link your life with, that you
yeah.
die.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really that.
Right.
A scary thought. And but yet she has this great commitment. And so this, it's this very emotional. I mean, you can imagine a play with this. Just a, and then the second chapter, she seems that they're going about the business of putting their life together. So it's very different tones. And kind of
yeah. Or the emotions are very different ones. But yes, there's a kind of the business of life and going out in the field and doing this work is the main theme. Okay, good. That's helpful. It's also the way, the business of getting on with your life or putting your life together implies there is some life to put together, you know, which they didn't feel like in that first chapter. Yeah. What other kinds of things did you notice?
This yeah. doesn't have anything to do with contrast, but mm-hmm. something that I just caught or thought about for the first time, mm-hmm. this time in the reading, and wondered if you had any insights into this, as the two sons and, who had married the two, Ruth and Orpah,
mm-hmm.
for 10 years, and no issue from either of those marriages. Has anything ever been said about that? I mean, is that the hand of God working for future?
Yeah. Nothing is mentioned about that in here, is it?
No, but I wondered if any...
I'm sure something has been said about that. I don't know. It's a good observation. That those relationships didn't get blessed with children, as they tend to talk about it in here. And that's curious. Did you want to add something to that? No? Okay.
Hey, yeah. To follow up a little bit on that. And it was pointed out earlier, the issue of having children, male children, and it went beyond simply not having someone coming, you know, children to provide for you in your old age and so forth, but in their understanding, you participated in the hope of Israel through your offspring, and in a sense to be at that point in your life where there was no one come after you,
yeah.
really meant that that you forfeited your opportunity to participate in the redemption of Israel,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and that's an idea that's pretty foreign to our
right.
thinking, because we have fastened on the individual promise of the resurrection, but at this point in Israel's history, that kind of concept is not really.
Right.
Really developed their understanding of how you participated in the future promise was
children
of your offspring.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was to really be facing a dead end.
Right.
And then the next chapter, of course, then in lingering in the background is the renewal of that hope. Well, something may happen. Something may restore that hope and that possibility.
Well, and the suggestion of that comes not just because somebody takes an interest in Ruth, but I think because you have a kinsman, they have no relatives in that first chapter. You know, there's the mother that she could have gone back to, and she leaves that. So here's, first of all, Naomi utterly isolated in Moab, and Ruth utterly isolated in Bethlehem, and their relationship not being the kind that counts, you know, as in terms of that ongoingness of the family. And so suddenly at the beginning of the second chapter there's a kinsman mentioned, and that shifts the tone, and they a way that story is told, they don't think about that until toward the end of the chapter, but they get quite excited about it when Ruth comes back and Naomi says, I'll call you in a second. When Naomi says, who, you know, how'd it go today? And she said, well, you know, here I came back with these things, and who was this man? And, well, his name was Boaz. Then Naomi said, blessed be he by the Lord. The man is a relative of ours, one of our nearest kin. And then Ruth says, he even said to me, stay close by my servants till they have finished all my harvest. So they're kind of bubbling over with their girlish excitement about these possibilities, I think. And it has to do with a kinship in addition to someone taking a special interest and there being food available. But I think there's a connectedness that's new in this chapter. Now,
This idea of kinsman redeemer is very much developed in a book called In the Barley Field.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a book about this story.
About this story, yes. Starting with this story. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think, you know, what David mentioned about how that was so important. And we talked about a little in our group about the traditions of that family, because Ruth and Naomi and Orpah were so close. You know, you wonder how that, the traditions of that, of Naomi's background and how they were steeped in that, and the loyalty that was there, that really was kind of the undergirding foundation of what took place.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
and their understanding of what the possibilities were if they did that.
I don't know if this is one thing you're getting at there, but I do get the feeling that Naomi must have been a very appealing person to begin with. Because when she returns to Bethlehem, people don't even quite believe that it's Naomi. She's so different. And Ruth and Orpah, for that matter, have this close affection to her, which, as you point out, it's hard to tell why they would, given the tone of Naomi here. Maybe that's connected to the traditions or whatever history there was there that you mentioned. There was something very strong in those relationships that then gets developed in good ways in the second chapter. Other things you want to mention about the way things move from chapter to chapter?
I think we're giving Naomi kind of a little bit of bad press. I don't read her that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're reading into that. Yes, she was bitter, but I still, I read it more as a gentle person who has some bitterness, an inner part of bitterness, but not necessarily a whiny old Jewish woman,
mm-hmm.
which I think we're kind of making it into.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I mean, she could have been. I have read of it.
Yeah.
Well, a fictionalized version of this, although the book was very, very true to the biblical account. It just fleshed it out, the story, but, and I may be influenced by that, but still, on the other hand, the people saying, is this Naomi? Well, she's been gone so long.
Right.
Regardless of how she comes back, is it really Naomi? Well, yeah. Obviously, she's at least 10 years older and probably changed a great deal.
Right.
Widowed and so on.
Yeah.
One factor in the story that interests me is this role of Ruth being protected. First of all, she's protected by having her physical needs supplied. There is that, you know, her hands are filled with the grain. But I think there's more at issue here where she is also protected against being molested.
Mm-hmm.
And that, that what's kind of involved here is preserving her for her future. If she had been molested in a serious way, it's not just that it would have been a horrendous experience for Ruth, but then she would not have been a vessel for the future. She could not have been taken as, you know, Boaz's wife, and she would not be the grandmother of David. And
so yeah.
She was being protected and preserved, not just for her own personal needs, but so that she will be what she needs to be in God's scheme for his people and her people.
Well, I was wondering, is it usual for the owner to come down during the harvest? I noticed that the word here before it says Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, the word before it is behold.
Yeah.
Which seems to indicate something of, it might have been something of a surprise to have had the owner of the field come down and check on what was going on.
Yeah. That word behold is a translation of a Hebrew word that doesn't come, it's not a good English translation of it, and it doesn't always indicate surprise or shock, but this is what happens right now.
Okay. Or a turn in the story?
Quite often when people are saying, mm-hmm. behold, some translations will translate it, look,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Which has that still literal sense of looking, that behold has. But it takes some of the excitement out of it. And I think it's used often just to say, right then, right now, this is what's happening. And so you would think that once in a while the owner would check out what's going on in the field.
It
seemed like a natural.
Serendipitous.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And that should be the field that she's gleaning in. There seems to be some good fortune here. And some question might be raised about how intentional Ruth's presence in that field is. They act like, you know, it's exciting to Naomi that it happens to be Boaz's field, and then she encourages her to stay in that field for her own safety, she says. But both of them are rather excited that this is this kinsman's field. I suppose we regard it as one of those fortuitous ways that.
Well, isn't this the hand of the Lord working?
Yeah.
Do you feel, Maury, that Ruth didn't know about Boaz? I mean, we don't have any. We don't know. I mean,
that's actually the question that I'm raising, and
yeah.
The story is presented as if she did not.
Right.
The sentence, verse 2 is a little ambiguous here.
Mm-hmm.
If verse 1 were not in there, we wouldn't worry about this.
Mm-hmm.
But since it's there, we start right away thinking, well, what about Boaz? And Ruth says, let me go and glean among the ears of grain behind someone in whose sight I may find favor. I think this means, let me hope to find someone who will give me permission to glean in their field. And not looking to the whole, the favor that she will find with Boaz and so on. But
the translation in the Revised Standard is simply after him, which is much more specific.
Mm. Yeah.
After him
in whose
sight I shall.
Yeah.
There must be some sense of that being a bit more specific than just anyone.
Well, no, I mean, that's what him means there.
Yeah, so I mean, whereas in yours it's just after someone, which
right.
could be interpreted as just any old person, or it could be interpreted after that person.
Well, I think that's what, in either case, it means I hope to find a field where I'll be permitted to glean.
Mm-hmm. The reference is not to the
West. Yeah, that's how I think it makes sense to read that. But it, since Boaz is mentioned as a prominent person in the community and a kinsman, you sort of wonder why that mm-hmm. sentence is there.
You have to go back to your notion of the small town again, though. Everyone knew Naomi. Obviously, Naomi also knew everyone.
Right.
I think there's conversation that no doubt took place here between Ruth and Naomi that's mm-hmm. not in the story.
Yeah.
That it was convenient for Ruth to find this field.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it was so much happenstance at all, but it was more, let's try
some before. Design. Yeah. Especially after you read chapter 3, then you think, that may be well what's happening in chapter 2 also, because there's some real assertiveness on the part of Ruth in chapter 3 that may be beginning even at the very outset when they get here, though the text doesn't present it quite in that light.
Well, it throws a different light on Ruth as a character.
Yes.
If we're going to have her just fall into this field, then you have to deal with chapter 3 and her aggressiveness and how does that play. Mm-hmm. Or do you have an aggressive player already by chapter 2?
Mm-hmm.
Which is fitting with chapter 1.
Well, yes.
Naomi is being a bit of a yenta.
Yeah, setting this up a little bit. Yeah, I think it makes sense to this. The way this story is told here, it allows a little more space for God to be providing this kind of help. But as we've said, always the individuals through whom God works are using their wits as well as they can. And one other contrast I wanted to mention, which I feel is important, is Naomi's perspective to God, which in the first chapter is, the hand of the Lord has turned against me. And at the end of chapter 2 is, blessed be he, that is Boaz, by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Her perspective on God's action in her life has completely changed in the course of one day. Apparently it's been one day of gleaning anyway that takes place here. And partly, I think, largely because of the agency of Ruth and what Ruth has done creatively here to make better things happen. I think it's very important for any of us in our own journeys in life, which take us into depths of discouragement and even depression, that we recognize and remember and hope for that action of God that can transform a perspective and can bring into a life that looks like it's full of death and despair and dead end a hope and a possibility and a perspective that recognizes that God is present even through all of this, bringing a new life and new possibilities, which is what happens for Naomi, even by chapter 2, and certainly in greater ways, as we'll see, by the end of this book. So excuse me for not letting you say what you wanted to say. but the bell has rung, and I hope some of you are able to come back tomorrow and finish this off. Now, do you want to have a last word to this?
Pick it up tomorrow.
Yeah, okay. More tomorrow. Thank you for today.